We're going to move into the presentation of the report, which is the next 30 minutes. Those of you that are standing in the back, there are a few seats here available, so feel free to take them while I find the presentation. All right, so let's begin. Our report basically builds along the lines of what the governor was mentioning. And the central theme of this particular issue is how to reconcile great expectations regarding Latin America, great expectations that come from within Latin America and from the outside, which I would just encapsulate in one word, which is optimism, while at the same time acknowledging that we live in a very volatile world and that things can change, and things can change very fast. So how do you reconcile these two realities is essentially what we're trying to do in this report. So another central theme here is we have to expand the policy toolkit, and we have to be pragmatic. And if anything we've learned, say, during the last 2 years, after the global recession, is that nothing is written in stone in terms of the macroeconomic policy textbook. So that pragmatism is also it permeates extensively in this report. So we're going to split the presentation in two parts. I am going to begin introducing the issues, essentially the motivation, and Eduardo is going to look at the taxonomy that we do regarding the policies that are available to countries. And he'll basically conclude as well. First thing is more than anything, it's a caveat. When we talk about Latin America, we're not really talking about Latin America. And it's important to say that at the beginning, because there are at least two Latin Americans. And nothing divides more these two Latin Americas than the balance of payments. There is one Latin America that has huge trade deficits, and there is one Latin America that until now has had trade surpluses. They're shrinking, but they're still trade surpluses. And there are many other ways to differentiate these two Latin Americas, but I think balance of payments, it's a good way to create this division. And roughly speaking, this corresponds to the division between Central America and the Caribbean and South America plus Mexico. But in practice, we're going to be talking here today essentially about what we call the Stellar Seven. Stellar Seven are seven countries that are doing relatively well: Mexico, Colombia, Peru, Chile, Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay. And this is the focus of our work. One aspect that is very characteristic about these LAC 7 or Stellar 7 is that they have been subject not just to these trade surpluses, which have been dominated by the expansion in volumes and prices of commodity exports, but also they've been receiving large and very significant amounts of capital inflows, and not just now. They've been doing this for quite a while, almost a decade, at least in the case of foreign direct investment. Portfolio flows are more recent, but essentially large capital inflows, which are taking different shapes and forms, but foreign direct investment still the leading character in that play. We hear very often, and this was the central theme in the conversation a few weeks ago during the annual meetings of the IDB in Calgary in Canada. It's mentioned by the managing director of the IMF, Mr. Strauss-Kahn, that there are signs of overheating in this group of the Stellar Seven. And that's clearly the case. And there are two ways of capturing that. One is that there are inflationary pressures. That's the most obvious of the symptoms of inflationary pressure, of overheating. But there is also an increase, a very large and fast increase in imports that is basically reducing the trade surplus. And as a result of that, of course, central banks, as we just heard from the governor of the Bank of Brazil, are beginning to tighten, what he said, are in the middle of the tightening phase. The only central bank that has not begun is the Central Bank of Banco de Mexico. But certainly, there is a monetary tightening. So one way of posing the question of these paper is whether this is enough, whether this is sufficient to cool down the economies and avoid this overheating. And our main argument is that it is not sufficient. One central theme is fiscal policy. And what we've looked at is the primary surplus adjusted for cyclical conditions. And naturally, when you run counter-cyclical fiscal policies, you want to have a large primary surplus when you have good times, like you have now, or you had in 2006 and 2007 prior to the global recession. And what we're seeing is that the countries were very good at stimulating the economies with fiscal policy, but they have not been so good and so apt at withdrawing the fiscal stimulus after the recession is gone and after we're not just back to normal times, but after Latin America is experiencing a significant external boom, external positive shocks. And for almost all the countries, primary surpluses are not where they should be given the current status of the cycle, of the business cycle. And in part of as a result of that, as a result of the two positive external shocks in terms of trade and capital inflows, currencies are appreciating, and this is a very strong upward trend that is not just causing concern everywhere in the region, but it's making people ask when is this going to stop, and it's causing a lot of trouble in many sectors of the economy, especially in manufacturing. And one aspect that we highlight in the report is in terms of employment. The generation of employment is very weak. So currency appreciation as a major concern. And, of course, this all will look fine, and we could all say, well, this is the new equilibrium, this is the new normal for the region, this is something that the region has to adapt to, because these are the new permanent conditions. But the more news come from China, I think the more we have to be realistic about the fact that China's expansion is not going to last forever. We first heard from no one less than Hu Jintao that China's long-term growth rate is expected to decelerate to 7%. In the next few years, down from the 9 to 10% range. And we also know from many pieces of evidence, recent papers by Barry Eichengreen, for example, that once countries reach a certain level of per capita income, the growth rate tends to decelerate, and that is something that can happen in China in about 2 years. And more importantly, if even you don't believe in those stories, the intensity in the demand for commodities decreases per unit of output when you reach certain levels of income. So people just don't want to buy more houses. They want to go to restaurants and they want to go to movies, and therefore they require less goods that are intensive in commodities. So we have to prepare for that. We have to prepare for the deceleration of China and the decline, as the future markets are already expecting, in the prices of commodities. And finally, another way to motivate this is that every now and then an investment house puts together a nice acronym to lump together a number of countries and saying that these are the most promising countries in the developing or emerging world. And we fell into that temptation. We did not find a nice acronym because there is not a good acronym for what we found. But we found that a number of countries in Latin America are moving up, and that's very good news. But also we found that there are some areas in which there is still a big gap in terms of the development process relative to Asia. And the two areas where Latin America is falling behind and we're still not at the level of East Asia are growth, stable growth, and also financial resilience, low levels of leverage, indebtedness, public debt, external debt, et cetera. So this, if anything, is saying, well, if we want to aspire to development, we need to make two things. One, keep the growth momentum by that stable rate, and two, take opportunity of these current economic conditions to save and reduce our financial vulnerabilities and make ourselves more resilient in that sense. That's really what's going to put us on the verge of development, and that's what is going to make us really benefit from what we now call the decade of Latin America. So that calls for a lot of prudence, and it calls for a number of policies that Eduardo is going to present.
Okay, thank you. The report, as usual, goes from general to particular. In this occasion, we chose to zoom in on something that's becoming a buzzword in the macro financial discussions, which is this term. Actually, the term that is typically used is macroprudential policies. And we wanted to dig a little bit deeper there and particularly take the approach of what I think is more popular, although not the approach that is given in the literature, which is policies to smooth out capital inflows and exchange rates. And I need to make this distinction because if you actually go to the economic literature and you look up the macro-financial term, it's typically used as a complement to micro-financial terms, micro-prudential terms, in the sense that it looks at systemic exposure to the financial sector as opposed to idiosyncratic exposure to the financial sector. In other words, macro-prudential was a term that became popular after the Asian crisis where the systemic shocks hit banks that were idiosyncratically very healthy, but were, for instance, holding currency imbalances. So the systemic shock essentially showed that overall the banking sector was not as healthy as thought. We are not talking about this particular definition when we are thinking of exchange rate intervention and capital controls. We're thinking a little bit closer to a definition that's more similar to what we would include into counter-cyclical macroeconomic policies, more standard counter-cyclical macroeconomic policies, and particularly exchange rate smoothing policies, against something that could be defined as a global financial cycle, which is, I think, a key concept that I want to develop a little bit more in this presentation, and we try to provide some illustrations and some evidence in the report. So, why? What do we mean by a global financial cycle? Or why would we care about changes in the exchange rate? That are, from an orthodox point of view, would be essentially, accommodation of the foreign exchange market to changes in what could be defined as an equilibrium real exchange rate. And why not leave the exchange rate adjust to what, in principle, is the equilibrium? Equilibrium that can be defined in a circular way as the exchange rate that would arise if nobody is intervening in the market. Well, here we try to develop an argument for intervention, which is essentially very simple. It's not based on the concept of misalignment, rather on the concept of global financial cycles that are driving this equilibrium real exchange rate. So let me be more precise. If you ask yourself what are the determinants of this equilibrium exchange rate, and if you look at the orthodox side of the literature, let's say this IMF survey of real exchange rate models, and try to list the key determinants of this equilibrium real exchange rate, we find a bunch of well-known factors, for instance, productivity differentials, the Balassa-Samuelson effect in the economic jargon, trade restrictions, price controls, government consumption, which are typically very stable over time. So if you don't see the cycle there, you know, productivity differentials move very slowly. So it's, this is not going to change dramatic changes in the real effective exchange rate. Now, equilibrium exchange rate. Now, if you look at the last two components, the last two factors are typically listed in these surveys, commodity terms of trade and net foreign assets. The truth is that if you look at their evolution during the recent, recent decade, you see that these are typically very highly synchronized and very cyclical. So, in a sense, the question here is not whether my exchange rate is currently misaligned. It's where will my equilibrium exchange rate will be in 1 or 2 years, and whether I should brace myself, prepare myself against sudden changes in the equilibrium exchange rate. It's not that we are trying to force a deviation from equilibrium. We are trying to hedge against a very volatile equilibrium, right, driven by these cyclical variables. And we're trying to, in this section of the report, we're trying to develop a little bit more empirically this argument. Just an aside, there is also one key driver that is not included in the models, but is very visible in the actual evolution of real effect, equilibrium exchange rates, which is the U.S. dollar. Of course, you know, U.S. policy, in particular trends in U.S. dollar, are reflected directly in equilibrium real exchange rates. So it's another cyclical factor is behind this equilibrium. The equilibrium is supposed to be an anchor, but this is a moving anchor. So what do we mean by global financial cycle? Well, you know, let me show you just a couple of very simple exercises. Imagine you take the capital inflows to emerging economies and try to capture, to filter a common factor using some econometric technique that I will not describe here. Yeah, I don't want to waste your time with that, but it's very, very precisely described in the paper, in the report. And you take a series of these common factors over time, and you do the same thing with changes in a real exchange rate for the same emerging markets. Those are the two lines that you see over there. So, and these two lines actually explain, for instance, in recent years, almost all the variability, the short-term variability of both flows and exchange rates. So, in fact, if you wanted to argue that the exchange rates and flows were actually being driven by country-specific improvements and a change in the country fundamentals, it would be very difficult to do that in light of this data because, you know, this thing is happening at the same time all over the emerging universe. There is something else there. And if you actually pick these trends and try to correlate these trends with global drivers, you will see that these trends are essentially driven by the U.S. interest rate, risk appetite, and commodity prices driven by global demand, particularly demand from the G7 and China. So in a sense, you know, most of the action, and particularly most of the action in recent years, has been driven by a few global drivers, right? If these drivers change, for instance, if China stops growing at 10% and starts growing at 7%, you will feel the effect both in flows. These flows, part of these flows will revert, and in exchange rates. Now the question is again, am I happy with just letting this dynamic, you know, move on and play out, or shall I prepare myself, try to minimize or reduce or smooth out this volatility you see, particularly in the recent period? The same happened with commodities. If we look at here, I'm focusing particularly on grains, which are, you know, probably the most relevant for the region. And if you look at commodities, they tend to move together, and you can actually extract again common trends that explain around 70 to 80% of everything that's happening in terms of changes in commodity prices. So, and again, if you want to, let me see if I don't have it here, but if you want to correlate these trends over there with a few global drivers, you will find precisely the same global drivers, U.S. interest rate, risk appetite, global demand. Point is that this global financial cycle, both in commodity terms of trade and in foreign inflows, is highly synchronized. So imagine that the interest rate in the U.S. predictably goes up, you know, unless they become Japan. Ultimately, they have to tighten interest rates, or that China actually goes to a 7% growth rate. Well, this cycle has to be reversed. So again, the question is not as much whether my exchange rate is currently misaligned. It's just where will my exchange rate, my real exchange rate, my equilibrium, be in 3 years? and whether I want to actually prepare for that, you know, minimize the swing. Why do I bother about these swings in the equilibrium exchange rate? Imagine that I accept that, you know, if I follow the equilibrium, my exchange will be all over the place. Why is that the problem? Well, you can actually obviously use some macroprudential measures to hedge against these movements, and some of these were mentioned by Governor Tombini. You can shield your banking sector, financial sector, through micro limits or taxes or provision requirements or liquidity ratios. But you can do that for the financial sector. It's much more difficult to do that for the economic structure, productive structure. So, for instance, if you look at what's going on, what has been going on for the last years in terms of the industrial versus primary sector dynamics, in some of these countries have been affected by the exchange rate appreciation. For instance, take the case of Chile. It's very easy to find incipient signs of what's typically called the Dutch disease, essentially a situation in which a very productive sector drives up the exchange rate, appreciates the currency at the expense of a less productive sector, typically the manufacturing of tradables. And how you look at that? Well, here we have four lines. If you look at this one here, this flat line is essentially the net exports of the primary sector in Chile. That means that they are not growing. I mean, they're not producing more copper, for instance, although the dollar income from this volume of net exports is going up with price. By contrast, if you look at the lower the bottom of the figure, you see this series over here is the net exports of the other sectors, particularly the industrial sector, and you see how it has been coming down in volume. It's at, you know, the net exportable production of manufacturing has been coming down recently, again, at the rhythm of the global cycle. I mean, it recovered a little bit during the recession, as typically does, and then continues with the downward trend. The same happened in Brazil. In Brazil, it's even more curious because Brazil was the country in Latin America that had a diversified production of exports, of tradables. They have a very well-diversified export menu, and they still have a trade, a trade surplus in their net manufacturing exports, although it has been coming down very steadily over the years. Now, what's behind that? Because this may be domestic consumption of this industrial output, so it may not be such a big problem, but if you look inside these sectors, you will see that the counterpart of this, the declining exports, are declining industrial shares and declining labor shares in the industry, in the manufacturing sector. So essentially these sectors are not only not exporting as much, they're not producing as much, and they are ceasing to create the high quality labor employments that the industrial sectors are presumed to create, right? And you know, there is you can see a shift from the industrial sector to services in many of these countries as a counterpart of this incipient Dutch disease. So in this light, what have these countries started to do? I mean, the section is called, it mentions the age of experimentation, in the sense that many of these countries were caught by surprise after the recovery by the sudden resumption, very fast resumption of capital inflows. And they are reacting defensively. I mean, there is no coordination. They're just trying different things to fend off these inflows while they're trying to keep their monetary policy relatively intact. And they're trying, as I say, different things. They're in some cases, they're using measures that were old and haven't been used for years, like, for instance, using reserve requirements as a substitute of interest rate policy, as in Turkey recently, or using ad hoc taxes on particular sectors of the economy so as to short-circuit the effect of these inflows on demand for consumer durables, which is, again, a transmission mechanism of these shocks to inflation. So they're inventing stuff, or they're combining things that were used 20, 25 years ago into a new toolkit that we can call a prudential macro toolkit. And in this section, we try to order a little bit these measures, because in our view, actually, there are essentially two big groups. The first one is obviously direct intervention, and the classical way in which this is is put in places by, you know, sterilized spot purchases of dollars by a central bank, although there has been a lot of foreign intervention, which implies, you know, no monetary, is neutral in terms of monetary policy, monetary aggregates, so doesn't need to be sterilized. But it also includes some, depending on the country, measures that go from debt dollarization, for instance, a change in the composition of debt, is issuing peso paper to pay dollar paper, essentially a way of changing the balance sheet of the country, but also substituting the dollar purchase of the central bank. Exactly the same thing. The central bank sterilized intervention is essentially issuing a peso paper and exchanging this for the dollar that the foreign investor is bringing to the country. So so the Treasury actually have taken part in some countries, in Chile, to a lesser extent in Brazil. And then we have another different group that is probably more controversial, the one that's been under heated discussion within the G20, and particularly in recent, around recent products published by the IMF, which is this sun in the wheel type of big, broad group. Essentially controls, but not only controls, or a little bit broader than capital controls, which instead of buying the inflows and absorbing them, it's taxing the inflows, trying to keep them away. So it's a different strategy. And there we have the Tobin tax measures like the IOU in Brazil. We have the unremunerated reserve requirements in Chile. We have a quantitative limit tax, as was the common case in Asia in the 90s. This is equivalent to an infinite tax. And then we have microprudential limits, like, you know, limits in foreign exchange position at banks. And ultimately, we have something that, although it looks like monetary policy, it could be subsumed in this taxing the flows group, which is this the use of reserve requirements as a substitute for interest rate hikes. How does it work? Well, the typical dynamic of this capital inflows is that any speculative investor positions itself to get the carry, which is the interest rate differential between the, say, the real and the U.S. Dollar. Imagine that the U.S. Rate is zero, just to simplify. The carry would be given by the real interest rate. What's a real interest rate? It's a passive rate. It's the deposit rate. That's the one that is arbitraged through the forward market. So if I increase reserve requirements, it means that it will be increasing the active lending rate without touching the deposit rate. So in a sense, I can tighten the economy, contract the monetary aggregate by taxing the banks, because the reserve requirement is, in a sense, a tax on financial intermediation without making my currency more appealing, without having to suffer the so-called offset effect, you know, of capitals coming back because now the interest rate is higher and the carry is higher as well. So anyway, we have this taxonomy. We have a table that I'm not going to go over because we don't have time and you can barely read. But this table in the report actually lists the recent applications of each of these particular intervention measures or particular items or lines that I described before. And you see that there is a wide variety, and some of these countries are actually intervening in many alternative ways at the same time. Now, the next question is, if we accept that we have to intervene and we take this taxonomy that just describes it, whether this works. And again, this is a point of controversy because some people... typically, when you think of capital controls, people's reaction is it's not only they are terribly damaging, but it's also completely useless, which is obviously a contradiction. Right? So they are either damaging or useless. But if they don't do anything, then it can't be damaging. Now, the question is whether they do something, or it's just, you know, fireworks that create distortions without any meaningful effect. Well, how can you measure that? Well, one way to measure this is essentially trying to correlate the real effective exchange rate measured in alternative ways with some measure of intervention, essentially the change in reserves, in this case normalized by the monetary base, essentially the firepower of the central bank intervention in terms of monetary aggregates. And if you run the regressions, of course, there are many more variables included here, but if you go to the bottom line of this exercise, you see that intervention actually has a positive effect on the real exchange rate. The real effective exchange rate here is in Bertie scale, so it's also positive. And either if you measure this by adjusting for purchasing power or in terms of, for instance, the real effective exchange rate that the IMF computes regularly. So and you have actually a lasting effect, because if you measure this over three-year periods, you still find you still find that the central bank dollar purchases increases, depreciates the currency. Now, how much, you know, is that this effect important? Because typically these regressions actually mask very little, economically very little effects. And if you actually do the math, try to put a size of on this intervention, essentially if you increase by 10% your reserves over M2 ratio, if you intervene at a moderate pace, you may get 3 to 4% depreciation of your currency, which is not zero, but small. What about... I lost one slide. What about capital controls? Well, again, you can actually measure the difference between the effect of capital controls by measuring the difference between the interest rate differential on the one hand and whatever you get in the forward market on the other. Essentially, the difference between the wedge that you gain by using capital controls instead of raising interest rate without getting a countervailing capital inflow. And this has been done many times, including a long time ago in Chile, for instance, during the one of the first showings of this Chilean type of controls by a couple of researchers, one of which will be here in a moment, which is José de Gregorio, current governor of the Central Bank of Brazil. And they found that, in fact, you created a wedge, a difference between, you know, the forward discount and the interest rate differential. You created the chance to raise the interest rate by a certain amount without having to face additional capital inflows. That's what they were measuring. And this wedge was around 2.5%, which was essentially the level of the tax. That makes sense. If you tax inflows by 2%, you will get a depreciation of 2%. Is it important? No, it's very small. If you really want to get 30% depreciation, you have to tax them, well, not exactly, but close to 30%. So in a sense, the bottom line of this analysis is that these exchange rate smoothing policies are not as powerful or nor as useless as typically, skeptics or promoters claim. And more importantly, I think they're not enough, and I think at this point, you know, particularly after hearing, listening to Governor Tombini and the talk that we had before getting into the session, I think that none of these policies alone, the fiscal policy, monetary policy, as Mauricio mentioned, or these prudential macro policies can actually revert the global financial cycle that is affecting these countries. They have to be used orderly as a single prudential macro counter cyclical macro toolkit. And even in that case, the only thing you would get is essentially smoothing out but not reverting these flows. So that's sort of the perspective I wanted to give in the report. I think I will stop here if I want to leave.